Falk pulled off the gloves. His hands were clammy. Clyde couldn't send over a couple of bodies to help you do a property search? Racco looked away, fiddled with the cigarette packet in his hands. Yeah, I don't know. Probably could. Right. Falk suppressed a smile. Racco may be sporting the uniform and talking the talk, but Falk had been around long enough to know the off-the-books probing when he saw it. Maybe Luke picked up a few odd spares somewhere, Falk suggested. Yeah, definitely could have, Racco said. Or the shots were the last in the box and he threw away the package. Yep. Although there was no sign of that in the household rubbish or his ute, and believe me, Racco gave a short laugh, I've checked. Where haven't you searched yet? Racco nodded at the missing weatherboard. On this property, I think this officially makes everywhere. Falk frowned. It's a bit weird. Yeah, that's what I thought too. Falk said nothing, just stared at him. Racco was sweating hard. His face, arms and clothes were covered in grime and dust from scrabbling around in the baking heat of the sheds. What else? Falk said. There was a silence. What do you mean? All this effort, down on your hands and knees all morning in a dead man's barn in this heat, Falk said. There's something more, or at least you think there's more. There was a long pause. Then Racco breathed out. Yeah, he said. There's more. Chapter 5. They'd sat for a while by the side of the house, backs up against the wall beside the loose panel and grass prickling the backs of their legs, making the most of the thin slice of shade while Racco ran through the facts. He started with the slightly detached air of someone who'd said it all before. It was 2 weeks ago today, he said, fanning himself loosely with a crinkled porn mag. A courier with a delivery found Karen and made the emergency call. That came in at about 5:40 p.m. To you? And Clyde and the local GP. The dispatcher notifies us all. GP was closest, so he was first on the scene. Dr. Patrick Lee. You know him? Falk shook his head. Anyway, he was first. Then I turn up a couple of minutes later. I pull up and the doors open and the doc's crouched over Karen in the hall, checking her vitals or whatever. Racco paused for a long moment, staring out at the tree line with an unfocused gaze. I'd never met her. Didn't even know who she was then. But he knew her. Had her blood all over his hands, and he's yelling, kind of screaming at me, you know, she's got kids, there might be kids. So, Racco sighed and flipped open Luke's aged pack of cigarettes. He put one between his lips and offered the pack to Falk, who surprised himself by taking one. He couldn't remember the last time he'd smoked. It might easily have been in this very same spot with his late best friend next to him. For whatever reason, taking one now felt right. He leaned in as Racco lit the ends. Falk took a drag and immediately remembered why he'd kicked the habit easily. But as he breathed deep and the smell of the tobacco mingled with the tang of the eucalyptus trees, the heady sensation of being 16 again hit him like the rush of nicotine. So anyway, Racco picked up. His voice was quieter now. The doc's yelling and I bolt off through the house. No idea who's in there, what I'm going to find, if there's someone about to step around a door with a shotgun. I want to call out to the kids, but I realise I don't even know their names, so I'm yelling, "Police, it's okay, come out, you're safe," or something, but I don't even know if it's true. He took a long drag, remembering. And then I hear this crying, this sort of wailing. So I follow it, not knowing what's waiting for me. And I go into the nursery and I see that little girl in her cot, screaming blue murder. And honestly, I've never been so glad to see a kid bawling her eyes out in all my life. Racco blew a plume of smoke into the air. "'Cause she was fine,' he said. I couldn't believe it. She was scared, obviously, but not hurt that I could see. And I remember thinking at that moment that it might all still be okay. Yes, it was sad about the mum, tragic, but thank God at least the kids were okay. But then I look across the hall and a door's ajar. He carefully ground his cigarette butt into the dirt, not looking at Fork. Fork felt a cold dread seep through him, knowing what was to come. And I can see it's another kid's room. All blue paint and car posters, you know, boys' room. And there's no sound coming from that one. So I go across the hall and push open the door, and then it definitely wasn't okay at all. He paused. That room was like a scene from hell. That room was the worst thing I've ever seen. They sat in silence until Reiko cleared his throat. Come on, he said, pulling himself to his feet, shaking his arms as if shedding the memory. Fork stood and followed him towards the front of the house. The response teams arrived from Clyde shortly after that, Reiko went on as they walked. Police, paramedics, it was nearly 6:30 by the time they got there. We'd searched the rest of the house and there's no one else there, thank Christ, so everyone was desperately trying to phone Luke Hadler. At first people are worried, you know, how he's supposed to break this to him, but then there's still no answer and his car's not there and he hasn't come home, and all of a sudden you could feel the mood start to shift. What was Luke supposed to have been doing then? A couple of the search and rescue volunteers, mates of his, knew he'd been helping a friend, Carl Rabbits, on his property that arvo. A guy called Jamie Sullivan. Someone phoned and Sullivan confirmed it, but said Luke had left his farm a couple of hours earlier by that point. They'd reached the front door, and Reiko pulled out a set of keys. When there was still no sign of Luke and no answer on his phone, we called some more of the search and rescue team in. Paired them up with officers, sent them out looking. It was a terrible couple of hours. We had unarmed searchers tramping through fields and bushland, not sure what they would find. Luke dead, alive, no idea what kind of state he'd be in. We were all panicking we'd find him holed up somewhere with a gun and a death wish. In the end, one of the search guys stumbled across his ute more by luck than anything. Parked up in some crappy clearing about 3 kilometres away. There was no need to worry after all. Luke was dead in the back, missing most of his face. His own gun, licensed, registered, completely legit, still in his hand. Reiko unlocked the farmhouse door and pushed it open. So it seemed like that was that, pretty much done and dusted. This, he stepped aside so Fork could see right down the long hallway, is where it starts to get strange. The entrance hall was muggy and stank of bleach. A side table piled with household clutter of bills and pens sat askew against a far wall, shoved from its original position. The tiled floor was ominously clean. The entire hallway had been scrubbed down to the original grout. The industrial cleaners have been through, so there aren't any nasty surprises, Reiko said. They couldn't save the carpet in the kids' bedroom, not that you'd want to. Family photos covered the walls. The frozen poses looked somehow familiar, and Fork realised he'd seen most of them at the funeral. The whole scene felt like a grotesque parody of the warm family home he'd known. Karen's body was found right here in the hallway, Reiko said. The door was open, so the courier saw her straight away. Was she running for the door? Fork tried to imagine Luke chasing his own wife through their own house. No, that's just it. She was answering it. Shot by whoever was standing on the doorstep, you can tell from the position of the body. But tell me this. When you come home at night, does your wife answer the door to you? I'm not married, Fork said. Well, I am, and call me liberated, but I've got a key to my own house. Fork considered. Catch her by surprise, maybe? He said, playing out the scenario in his mind. Why bother? Dad comes home waving a loaded shotgun. I reckon they'd still be pretty bloody surprised. He's got them both inside the house, knows the layout. Too easy. Fork positioned himself inside the hall and opened and closed the door a few times. Open, the doorway was a rectangle of blinding light compared with the dimness of the hall. He imagined Karen answering the knock, a little distracted maybe, perhaps annoyed by the interruption, blinking away the brightness for the crucial second it took her killer to raise a gun. "Just strikes me as odd," Rako said. "Shooting her in the doorway, all it did was give that poor kid a chance to piss his pants and bolt, not necessarily in that order." Rako looked past Fork. "Which brings me to my next point," he said, "when you're ready." Fork nodded and followed him down the bowels of the hall. As Rako snapped on the light in the small blue bedroom, Fork's first dizzy impression was that someone was renovating. A child's bed had been shoved against the far wall at an angle, stripped back to the mattress. Toys were piled in boxes and stacked haphazardly beneath posters of football players and Disney characters. The carpet had been ripped out, exposing untreated floorboards. Fork's boots left patterns in a layer of sawdust. The boards in one corner had been heavily sanded. A stain still remained. Rako lingered by the doorway. "Still difficult for me to be in here," he said with a shrug. This had once been a nice bedroom. Fork knew. 20 years ago it had been Luke's own. Fork had slept there himself many times, whispering after lights out, holding his breath and stifling giggles when Barb Hadler called through to them to shut up and go to sleep. Wrapped warm in a sleeping bag, not far from those floorboards with their awful stain. This room had been a good space. Now, like the hall, it stank of bleach. "Can we open the window?" "Better not," Rako said. "Got to keep the blinds down. Caught a couple of kids trying to take photos soon after it happened." Rako pulled out his tablet computer and tapped it a few times. He handed it to Fork. On the screen was a photo gallery. "The little boy's body's been removed," Rako said, "but you can see how the room was found. In the photos, the blinds were wide open, spilling light onto a horrendous scene below. The wardrobe doors were flung wide open, and the clothes had been roughly pushed aside. A large wicker toy box was overturned. On the bed, a spaceship duvet was rucked up on one side, as though tossed back to check what was under it. The carpet was mostly beige, except for the one corner where a rich red-black pool seeped out from behind a large, upended laundry basket. For a moment, Fork tried to imagine Billy Hadler's last moments, huddled behind the laundry basket, hot urine dribbling down his leg as he tried to silence ragged breaths. "You got kids?" Rako asked. Fork shook his head. "You?" "One on the way, a little girl." "Oh, congratulations. We've got an army of nieces and nephews, though. Not here, back home in South Australia. A few around Billy's age, a couple a bit younger," Rako said, taking back the tablet and scrolling through the photos. "And the thing is, my brothers know every one of their kids' hiding places. You send them blindfolded into their kids' bedrooms and they could find them in 2 seconds. He tapped the screen. "Every possible way I look at these photos, it looks like a search," Rako said. "Someone who didn't know Billy's hiding spots methodically working his way through. Is he in the cupboard? No. Under the bed? No. It's like the kid was hunted down." Fork stared hard at the dark smudge that had once been Billy Hadler. "Show me where you found Charlotte." The nursery across the hall was decorated in yellow. A musical mobile dangled from the ceiling above an empty space. "Jerry and Barb took the cot," Rako explained. Fork looked around the room. It felt so different from the others. Furniture and carpet still intact. No acrid bleach stink in there. It had the feel of a sanctuary, untouched by the horror that had unfolded outside the door. "Why didn't Luke kill Charlotte?" Fork said. "The popular money's on conscience and guilt kicking in." Fork walked out, back across the hall to Billy's bedroom. He stood at the bloodstain in the corner, turned 180 degrees, and strode back across the hall into Charlotte's room. 8 steps, Fork said, "but I'm pretty tall, so we'll call it 9 for most people. 9 steps from Billy's body to where Charlotte was lying like a sitting duck. And Luke would have had the adrenaline going, blood pumping, red mist, the works. So 9 steps. The question is that enough time for a total change of heart?" "Doesn't sound like enough to me." Fork thought about the man he'd known. what had once been a clear picture was now distorted and fuzzy. "Do you ever meet Luke?" he said. "No." He could change his mood like flipping a coin. 9 steps could be 8 more than he needed. But for the first time since he'd returned to Kiwara, Fork felt a pinprick of genuine doubt. "It's supposed to be a statement, though, isn't it? Something like this. It's personal. He murdered his entire family. That's what you want people to say. Luke's wife of 7 years is bleeding out on the hall floor, and he spent, what, 2 minutes, 3, turning the bedroom upside down to murder his own son? He's planning to kill himself when he's finished, so if it was Luke..." He hesitated slightly on the word "if." "Why does his daughter get to live?" They stood for a moment, both looking at the mobile hanging still and silent above the empty cot space. Why slaughter a whole family bar the baby? Fork turned it back and forth in his mind until he could think of a few reasons, but only one good one. Maybe whoever was here that day didn't kill the baby because they just didn't need to kill the baby, Fork said finally. "Nothing personal about it. Doesn't matter who you are. 13-month-olds don't make good witnesses." Chapter 6. "They're not crash hot about me coming in here, generally," Reiko said with a note of regret, as he put 2 beers on the table at the Fleece. It lurched lopsidedly under the weight, slopping a centimetre of liquid over the scratched surface. He'd been home to change out of his uniform and had returned with a thick file labelled "Hadler" under his arm. "I'm not great for business. Everyone always has to make a big show of putting their car keys away." They glanced over at the barman. It was the same large, bearded bloke from the night before. He was watching them over the top of a newspaper. "Policeman's lot. Cheers." Fork raised his glass and took a long swallow. He'd always been able to take or leave the booze, but at that moment he was glad of it. It was early evening quiet in the pub, and they were holed up alone in a corner. On the far side of the room, 3 men stared with bovine blankness at greyhound racing on the TV. Fork didn't recognise them, and they ignored him in turn. In the back room, the poker machines blinked and whistled. The air conditioning was blowing arctic cold. Reiko took a sip. "So what now?" "Now you tell Clyde you've got concerns," Fork said. "I go to the Clyde cops now, it'll send them straight into arse-covering mode." Reiko frowned. "You know what'll be going through their heads if they think they've stuffed this up. They'll make a gymnastics team bending over backwards to prove their investigation was sound. I know I would." "I'm not sure you've got a choice. Something like this. It's not a one-man job." "We've got Barnes."
"Who?"
"My constable at the station. So that's 3 of us."
"That's only 2 of you, mate," Fork said. "I can't stay."
"I thought you told the Hadlers you would."
Fork rubbed the bridge of his nose. The pokies behind him clanged more loudly. He felt like the noise was inside his head. "For a couple of days. That means 1 or 2. Not for the duration of an investigation, an unofficial one at that. I've got a job to get back to."
"Fine." Reiko spoke like it was obvious. "Stay for the couple of days and it doesn't have to be anything on the books. Do what you said you'd do on the money side. As soon as we get something solid, I'll go to Clyde."
Fork said nothing. He thought about the 2 boxes of bank statements and documents he'd taken from the Hadler's place that were now sitting upstairs on his bed.
"Luke lied. You lied."
He picked up their empty glasses and took them back to the bar.
"See him again?" The barman hauled his bulk off a stool and put his newspaper down. He was the only person Fork had seen working in the place since yesterday.
"Listen," Fork said as he watched a clean glass put under the tap. "That room I'm in, likely to be available a bit longer?"
"Depends." The barman set 1 beer on the counter. "I've been hearing 1 or 2 whispers about you, my friend."
"Have you?"
"I have. And while I welcome the business, I don't welcome trouble, see? Tricky enough running this place as is. The trouble won't come from me. Just comes with you. Not much I can do about that. You know I'm police, though."
"I did hear of that indeed, but out here in the sticks at midnight with a few boozed-up fellas looking for aggro, those badges mean less than they should, you get me?
Fine. Well, up to you. He wasn't going to beg. The barman put the second glass on the counter with a half smile. It's all right, mate. You can untwist your knickers. Your money's as good as the next man's, and that's good enough for me. He gave Fork his change and picked up the newspaper. He appeared to be doing the cryptic crossword. Take it as a friendly warning, though. There can be a funny lot around here. You find yourself in hot water. There's not always a lot of help at hand. He eyeballed Fork. Although, from what I hear, you don't need telling about that. Fork took both glasses back to the table. Reiko was staring moodily at a soggy beer mat. You can lose the look, Fork said. You better fill me in on the rest. Reiko slid the folder across the table. I've pulled this together from all the stuff I've got access to, he said. Fork glanced around the pub. It was still half empty. No one nearby. He flipped it open. The first page had a photo of Luke's ute taken from a distance. A pool of blood had collected by the back wheels. He closed the file. Just give me the highlights for now. What do we know about the courier who found them? He's looking as clean as you'd want to be. Works for an established delivery firm. Has done for 2 years. He was delivering recipe books Karen had ordered online. That checks out. He was running late, last delivery of the day, first time he'd made a delivery to Kiwara. Says he rocked up, saw Karen lying in the doorway, chucked up his lunch into the flower bed and jumped back in his van. Made the emergency call from the main road. He left Charlotte in the house? Reckons he didn't hear her, Reiko shrugged. Maybe he didn't. She'd been alone for a while, might have cried herself out by then. Fork turned to the first page of the file, kept it open this time. He'd always assumed Luke had been found in the ute's driver's seat, but the images showed his body flat on its back in the cargo tray. The lip of the tray was open, and Luke's legs dangled over as though he'd been sitting on the edge. A shotgun by his side pointed towards the mess where his head would have been. His face was completely missing. You're right? Reiko was watching him closely. Yeah. Fork took a long drink from his beer. The blood had spread across the bottom of the cargo tray, settling in the metal ridges. Forensics find anything useful in the tray? Fork asked. Reiko checked his notes. Other than lots of blood, all Luke's, nothing particular noted, he said. I'm not sure how well they looked, though. They had the weapon. It was a working vehicle. He had all sorts of stuff in the back. Fork looked again at the photo, concentrating on the area around the body. Barely visible along the left interior side of the tray were four faint horizontal streaks. They looked fresh. Light brown against the dusty white paintwork. The longest was maybe 30 centimetres, the shortest about half that. They were in pairs of two, each pair about a metre apart. The placement wasn't particularly uniform. The right-hand streaks were horizontal. Those on the left had a slight tilt. What are these? Fork pointed and Reiko leaned in. I'm not sure. Like I said, ute would have carried all sorts. The ute still here? Reiko shook his head. Sent to Melbourne. It'll be cleaned up by now for sale or scrap, I reckon. Fork looked through the photos, hoping for a better view, but was disappointed. He read over the rest of the notes. Everything appeared fairly standard. Other than the hole in the front of his head, Luke Hadler was a healthy male. A couple of kilos over his ideal weight, slightly high cholesterol, no drugs or alcohol in his system. Fork said, "What about the shotgun?" "Definitely Luke's gun used on all three of them, registered, licensed. His fingerprints were the only ones on it. Where did he keep it normally? Secured locked box in the barn out the back, Reiko said. The ammo, at least the Winchester stuff I've found, was locked away separately. He was pretty big on safety by the look of things. Fork nodded, only half listening. He was looking at the fingerprint report from the shotgun. Six crisp ovals, embroidered with tight whorls and lines. Two less clear. Slight slippage, but still confirmed as belonging to the left thumb and right little finger of Luke Hadler. The fingerprints are good, Fork said. Reiko caught his tone, looked up from his notes. Yeah, really solid. People didn't take too much convincing after seeing them.
Very solid, Falk said, sliding the report over the table to Reiko.
Maybe too solid?
The guy's supposed to have just killed his family. He would have been sweating and shaking like an addict. I've seen worse than these taken under evidence conditions.
Shit.
Reiko frowned at the prince.
Yeah, maybe.
Falk turned the page. What did forensics find in the house?
They found everything. Seemed like half the community had traipsed through there at one time or another. About 20 different fingerprints, not including partials, fibres everywhere. I'm not saying Karen didn't keep the place clean, but it was a farm with kids.
Witnesses? The last person to see Luke alive was this mate of his, Jamie Sullivan. Has a farm to the east of town. Luke had been helping him shoot rabbits. Arrived in the Arvo about 3, left about 4:30, Sullivan reckons. Other than that, around the Hadless house there's really only one neighbour who could have seen something. He was on his own property at the time.
Reiko reached for the report. Falk felt a heavy weight in his stomach.
Neighbour's a strange bloke, though, Reiko went on. Aggressive old bastard. No love lost for Luke, whatever that's worth. Not at all keen to assist the police with their inquiries.
Mal Deacon, Falk said. He made a point of keeping his voice even.
Reiko looked up in surprise.
That's right. You know him?
Yeah.
Reiko waited, but Falk said nothing more. The silence stretched on.
Well, anyway, Reiko said, he lives up there with his nephew, bloke called Grant Dow, who wasn't home at the time. Deacon reckons he didn't see anything. Might have heard the shots, but didn't think anything of it. Thought it was farm stuff.
Falk just raised his eyebrows.
Thing is, what he did or didn't see might not matter anyway, Reiko said, taking out his tablet and tapping the screen. A low-res colour image appeared. Everything was so still that it took Falk a minute to realise it was a video rather than a photograph.
Reiko handed in the tablet. Security footage from the Hadless farm.
You're kidding, Falk gaped at the screen. Nothing fancy, barely a step up from a nanny cam, really, Reiko said. Luke installed it after a spate of equipment burglaries around here a year ago. Few of the farmers have them. Records for 24 hours, uploads the footage to the family computer, gets wiped after a week if no one actively saves it. The camera appeared to be positioned above the largest barn. It was directed towards the yard to capture anyone coming or going. One side of the house was in shot, and in the upper corner of the screen, a slim slice of driveway was visible. Reiko skipped through the recording until he found the spot he was looking for and paused it. Okay, this is the afternoon of the shootings. You can watch the whole day later if you want, but in a nutshell, the family leaves the house in the morning separately. Luke drives off in his ute just after 5 a.m, headed out to his own fields as far as I've been able to tell. Then shortly after 8, Karen, Billy and Charlotte leave for school. She worked there part-time in an admin role and Charlotte was in the on-site crash. Reiko tapped the screen, starting the footage. He passed Falk a pair of earphones and plugged them into the tablet. The sound was poor and muffled as wind buffeted the microphone.
Nothing happens during the day, Reiko said. Believe me, I've watched the entire thing in real time. No one comes and no one goes until 4:04 p.m. when Karen and the kids get home.
In the corner of the screen, a blue hatchback trundled by and disappeared. It was on an angle, visible only from the bonnet down to the tyres. Falk could just make out the front number plate.
You can read that if you freeze it and blow it up, Reiko said. It's definitely Karen's car.
Above the electronic crackling, Falk heard the thud of a car door slamming, followed a moment later by a second one.
Reiko tapped the screen again. The image jumped.
Then it's all quiet for nearly an hour. Again, I've checked. Until here, 5:01 p.m.
Reiko pressed play and let Falk watch. For a few long seconds, all was still. Then a shape moved in the corner. The silver ute was taller than the hatchback and only visible from the headlights down. The number plate was visible. Again, the vehicle was there and gone in less than a second.
Luke's, Reiko said.
The image on screen was completely static, although the footage was still rolling. There was the thud of an invisible car door again, then nothing for an agonizing 20 seconds. Suddenly, a dull boom crashed in Fork's ears, and he flinched. Karen. He felt his heart thumping in his chest. The scene was still again as the timer continued to tick over. 60 seconds gone, then 90. Fork realized he was holding his breath, willing there to be a different ending. He was both frustrated and grateful at that moment for the poor sound. Billy Hadler's screams would be the haunting kind. When the second boom came, it was almost a relief. Fork blinked once. There was no movement. Then 3 minutes and 47 seconds after the ute had first appeared, it rattled away through the corner of the screen. The back wheels, the bottom of the tray, and the number plate of Luke Hadler's vehicle were all perfectly visible. No one else comes or goes until the courier 35 minutes later, Rako said. Fork handed the tablet back to him. He could still hear the muffled booms ringing in his ears. You seriously think there's doubt after seeing that? Fork said. It's Luke's ute, but you can't see who's driving it, Rako said. Plus the other stuff, the ammunition, killing Karen on the doorstep, the search in Billy's room. Fork stared at him. I don't get it. Why are you so convinced it wasn't Luke? You didn't even know him. Rako shrugged. I found the kids, he said. I had to see what Billy Hadler looked like after some monster killed him, and I'll never be able to unsee that. I want to make sure the right thing's been done by him. I know it seems crazy, and look, odds are probably Luke did do it. I admit that. But if there's a tiny chance that someone else has done this and got away with it? Rako shook his head and took a long drink. You know, I look at Luke Hadler, and on the surface, he had it all. Great wife, two kids, decent enough farm, respect in his community. Why would a man like that turn around one day and destroy his family? It makes no sense. I just can't understand how someone like him could do something like that. Fork rubbed a hand over his mouth and chin. It felt gritty. He needed a shave. Luke lied. You lied. Rako, he said, there's something about Luke you need to know. Chapter 7. Back when Luke and I were kids, Fork said. Well, not exactly kids, older than that, 16 actually. He broke off as he sensed a swell of movement at the other end of the bar. The place had filled up without Fork noticing, and when he looked up now, more than one familiar face glanced away. Fork felt the ripple of disruption a moment before he saw it. Drinkers lowered their eyes and shuffled aside without complaint as a group moved through the crowd. At the head was a meaty bloke with sludge-brown hair topped by sunglasses. Fork felt a cold trickle seep through his guts. He may not have recognised Grant Dow at the Hadler's funeral, but there was no mistaking him now. Ellie's cousin. They had the same eyes, but Fork knew there was absolutely nothing of her in him. Dow stopped in front of their table, his flabby frame blocking their view. His T-shirt advertised a Balinese beer brand. His features were piggy, small and cramped together in the middle of his face, while his beard straggled across a thick chin. He was wearing the same look of defiance he'd used to stare down the mourners at the wake. Dow raised his glass towards Fork in a mock salute and flashed a smile that went nowhere near his eyes. You got balls turning up here, he said. I'll give you that much. Don't you reckon Uncle Mal give him that much, eh? Dow turned. An older man hidden behind him took a shaky step forward, and Fork came face to face with Ellie's father for the first time in 20 years. He felt something lodge in his chest and caught himself swallowing. Mal Deacon had a curve to his spine now, but was still a tall man with ropey arms leading to large hands. His fingers were knotted and swollen with age and were almost white as he gripped the back of a chair for support. His forehead furrowed deep into a scowl, and his exposed scalp was angry pink between strands of grey hair. Falk braced himself for an outburst, but instead a look of confusion flashed across Deacon's face. He shook his head slightly, the loose chicken flesh on his neck rubbing against a dirty collar.
"Why are you back?"
Deacon's voice was slow and raspy. Deep grooves appeared on either side of his mouth as he spoke. Every single person in the pub was determinedly looking elsewhere, Falk noted. Only the barman was following the exchange with interest. He had put down his crossword.
"Hey?"
Deacon slammed a gnarled hand against the back of the chair and everyone jumped.
"Why are you back? I thought you got the message clear enough. You brought the kid with you as well?"
It was Falk's turn to look confused.
"What?" "That bloody son of yours. Don't act dumb with me, dickhead. He back too, your boy?"
Falk blinked. Deacon had mistaken him for his late father. He stared at the old man's face. Deacon scowled back, but there was something sluggish about his anger. Grant Dow stepped forward and put a hand on his uncle's shoulder. For a moment, he appeared to consider explaining the mistake, then shook his head in frustration and gently forced his uncle into a chair.
"Nice one, you prick. You've gone and upset him now," Dow said to Falk.
"I've got to ask you, mate. You think this is the best place for you to be?" Rako pulled his Victoria Police badge out of his jeans pocket and slapped it face up on the table.
"I could ask you the same thing, Grant. This the best place for you right now, you reckon?"
Dow held up his palms and twisted his face into a picture of innocence.
"Yeah, all right, no need for that. Me and my uncle are just out for a social drink. He's not well, you can see that yourselves. We're not the ones looking for any trouble. This one, though."
He looked straight at Falk. "He tracks it behind him like dog shit." An almost imperceptible murmur rolled through the room. Falk had known the story would resurface sooner rather than later. He shifted as he felt every eye in the place glance towards him. The hikers were hot and bored. The mosquitoes were out in force and the track by the Kiwara River was proving slower going than they'd expected. The three of them trudged along in single file, bickering when they could be bothered to raise their voices over the sound of rushing water. The second in line swore as he ran chest first into the group's leader's backpack, spilling his open water bottle down his front. A former investment banker, he'd moved to the country for his health and had spent each day since trying to convince himself he didn't hate every minute of it. The leader held up his hand and cut short the grumbling. He pointed to the murky river water. They turned and stared. "What the hell is that?"
"All right, we'll have none of that, thanks,"
the barman called out from behind the counter. He got to his feet and was resting his fingertips on the countertop. Beneath his orange beard, he was unsmiling.
"This is a public bar. Anyone can drink here. Him, you, and you can take it or leave it." "What's the third option?"
Dow flashed his yellow teeth at his mates, who dutifully laughed.
"Third option is you're barred.
So, your choice."
"Yeah, always making those promises though, aren't you?"
Dow stared at the barman. Rako cleared his throat, but Dow ignored him. The barman's words came back to Falk. "Out here, those badges mean less than they should."
"The problem's not with him being in the bar."
The room was almost silent as Mal Deacon spoke. "It's him being back in Kiwara at all." He raised a finger thick with arthritis and pointed it between Falk's eyes.
"Understand this and tell your boy. There's nothing here for you, except a lot of people who remember what your son did to my daughter."
The investment banker vomited his ham sandwiches into the bush. He and the other two were soaking wet, but he barely noticed. The girl's body now lay on the trail, a pool of water seeping out around her. She was slim, but it had taken all three of them to drag her to the bank. Her skin was unnaturally white, and a slick of hair had fallen into her mouth. The sight of it disappearing between her pale lips made the investment banker gag again. Her earlobes were red raw around the piercings. The fish had taken the opportunity. The same markings were visible around her nostrils and painted fingernails. She was fully clothed and looked young where the water had washed her makeup away. Her white t-shirt was almost transparent as it clung to her skin, displaying her lace bra beneath. Her flat boots were still tangled with traces of the weeds that had tethered her body to the spot. Both boots and every pocket of her jeans had been packed tight with stones. Bullshit. I had nothing to do with what happened to Ellie. Falk couldn't help himself and instantly regretted it. He bit down on his tongue. Don't engage.
Who says?
Grant Dow stood behind his uncle. His cold grin was long gone. Who says you had nothing to do with it?
Luke Hadler?
As he said the name, it felt like air had been sucked out of the bar.
The thing about that is, Luke's not here to say much of anything anymore.
The fittest of the trio had run for help. The investment banker sat on the ground near his own pool of vomit. He felt safer there, engulfed in the acid stink, than near that horrific white being. The group leader paced, his feet squelching. They could guess who she was. Her photo had been in the paper for 3 days. Eleanor Deacon, age 16, missing since Friday night when she failed to return home. Her father had given her a night to cool whatever teenage impulse might have been keeping her away. When she didn't come home on Saturday, he'd raise the alarm. It had seemed like an age before emergency workers arrived at the river. The girl's body was taken to the hospital. The investment banker was sent home. Within a month, he'd moved back to the city. The doctor examining Ellie Deacon's body reported the cause of death as drowning. Her lungs were soggy with the river. She appeared to have been in the water for several days, he noted, most likely since Friday. He reported some bruising on her breastbone and shoulders and abrasions on her hands and arms, not inconsistent with damage caused by debris rushing past in the water. There were some old scars on her forearms, possibly evidence of self-harm. She was not, he noted, as an afterthought, a virgin. At the mention of Luke's name, there was a ripple around the room, and even Dow seemed to sense he'd gone too far. Luke was my friend. Ellie was my friend. Falk's voice sounded strange to his own ears. I cared about them both. So back off. Deacon stood up, his chair squealing against the floorboards.
Don't you talk to me about caring for Ellie. To me, she was blood.
He was shouting, his hands shaking as he thrust a finger at Falk in accusation. Out of the corner of his eye, Falk saw Rako and the barman exchange looks.
You reckon you and your boy had nothing to do with it? Deacon said. What about the note, you lying bastard?
He said it with a flourish, like a conversational trump card. Falk felt the air go out of him. He felt exhausted. Deacon's mouth was twisted. Next to him, his nephew was laughing. He could smell blood.
Not so quick with an answer to that, are you?
Dow said. Falk forced himself not to shake his head. Jesus, that bloody night. The cops spent 2 hours picking apart Ellie Deacon's bedroom. Thick fingers awkwardly probed through underwear drawers and jewellery cases. The note was almost missed. Almost. It was written on a single page torn from an ordinary exercise book. It had been folded once and slipped into the pocket of a pair of jeans. On the page, written in pen in Ellie's handwriting, was the date she had disappeared. Underneath that was a single name. Falk.
Explain that. If you can,
Deacon said. The bar was silent. Falk said nothing. He couldn't, and Deacon knew he couldn't. The barman banged a glass down on the counter.
Enough!
He looked hard at Falk, considering. Rako, holding his police badge visibly in his palm, raised his eyebrows and gave a tiny shake of his head. The barman's eyes instead settled on Dow.
You and your uncle leave. Don't come back for 2 days, thanks. Everyone else? Buy a drink or get out.
The rumours started small, and by the end of the day were big. Fork, 16 and scared, holed up in his bedroom with 1,000 thoughts clamouring. He jumped as a tap sounded against the window frame. Luke's face appeared, ghostly white in the evening gloom.
"You're in the shit, mate," he whispered. "I heard my mum and dad say people are talking. What were you really doing on Friday after school?"
"I told you, fishing. Upriver, though, miles away, I swear."
Fork crouched by the window. His legs felt like they wouldn't hold him up.
"Anyone else asked you yet? Cops or anyone?"
"No, the guy knew, though. They think I was meeting her or something."
"But you weren't."
"No, of course not. But what if they don't believe me?"
"You didn't meet anyone at all? No one saw you?"
"I was on my bloody own, wasn't I?"
"Right, listen. Aaron, mate, are you listening? Right, anyone asks, you say we were shooting rabbits together on the back fields."
"Nowhere near the river?"
"No, the fields off Curran Road, nowhere near the river. All evening, okay, we were mucking around. Like usual, we only hit one or two. Two, say two."
"Yeah, okay, two.
Don't forget, we were together."
"Yeah, I mean, no, I won't forget." "Oh, Jesus, Ellie, I can't say it."
"What?" "Say it now, what you were doing. Practice."
"Luke and I were shooting rabbits together."
"Again." "I was with Luke Hadler shooting rabbits out on the Curran Road fields."
"Say it until it sounds normal and don't get it wrong."
"No." "You got all that, yeah?"
"Yes. Luke, mate, thanks. Thank you."
Chapter 8. When Aaron Fork was 11, he'd seen Mal Deacon turn his own flock into a staggering, bleeding mess using shearing clippers and a brutal hand. Aaron had felt an ache swell in his chest as he, Luke and Ellie had watched one sheep after another brawled to the ground of the Deacon's shed with a sharp twist and slice too close to the skin. Aaron was a farm kid, they all were, but this was something else. A pitiful cry from the smallest ewe made him open his mouth and draw breath, but he was cut short as Ellie pulled him away by his sleeve. She looked up at him and gave a single shake of her head. She'd been a slight, intense child at that age, prone to long bouts of silence. Aaron, who leaned towards the quiet side himself, found that suited him fine. They usually let Luke do the talking. Ellie had barely raised her head when the noises from the barn had floated over to where the three of them had been sitting on the sagging porch. Aaron had been curious, but it had been Luke who insisted they abandon their homework to investigate. Now, with the wails of the ewes in their ears and Ellie's face fixed into an expression he hadn't seen before, Aaron knew he wasn't the only one wishing they hadn't. They turned to leave, and Aaron jumped as he saw Ellie's mother watching silently from the barn's doorway. She was jammed up against the frame wearing an ill-fitting brown jumper with a single greasy stain on it. She took a sip of amber liquid from a glass without taking her eyes off the shearing. Her facial features were shared by her daughter. They had the same deep-set eyes, sallow skin and wide mouth. But to Aaron, Ellie's mother looked 100 years old. It was years before he realised on that day she would not have even been 40. As he watched, Ellie's mother closed her eyes and tilted her head back sharply. She took a deep breath, her features creasing. When she opened her eyes again, they fixed on her husband, staring at him with a look so pure and undiluted, Aaron was terrified Deacon would turn and see it for himself. Regret. The weather that year had made the work harder for everyone, and a month later Deacon's nephew Grant had moved into their farmhouse to lend a hand. Ellie's mother left 2 days after that. Perhaps it had been the final straw. One man to resent was plenty enough for anyone. Throwing two suitcases and a clinking bag of bottles into an old car, she had tried half-heartedly to stem her daughter's tears with weightless vows that she would be back soon. Fork wasn't sure how many years it had been until Ellie had stopped believing it. He wondered if part of her might have believed it until the day she died. Fork now stood on the porch of the fleece with Rako while the sergeant lit a cigarette. He offered the packet and Fork shook his head. He'd spent enough time down memory lane for one night.
Smart choice, Rako said. I'm trying to quit for the baby.
Right. Good on you. Rako smoked slowly, blowing the vapour into the hot night sky. The pub noise had ratcheted up a notch. Deacon and Dow had taken their time leaving, and the hint of aggression still hung in the air.
You should have told me earlier.
Rako took a drag, suppressed a cough. I know, I'm sorry.
You have anything to do with it, that girl's death?
No, but I wasn't with Luke when it happened, not like we said. Rako paused.
So you lied about your alibi. Where was Luke?
I don't know.
You never asked?
Of course I did, but he...
Fork paused, remembering.
He always insisted on sticking to our story, always, even when it was only the two of us. He said it was safer to be consistent.
I didn't push it. I was grateful to him, you know. I thought it was for my benefit.
Who else knew it was a lie?
Few people suspected. Mal Deacon, obviously. Some others, but no one knew for certain. At least that's what I always thought, but now I'm not sure.
Turns out Jerry Hadler knew all along.
Maybe he's not the only one.
Do you think Luke killed Ellie?
I don't know.
He stared out at the empty street.
I want to know.
You think all this is connected?
I really hope not.
Rako sighed. He stubbed the cigarette out carefully, then doused the butt with a splash of beer.
All right, mate, he said. Your secret's safe with me, for now. Unless it needs to come out, in which case you sing like a canary and I knew nothing about any of it, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Meet me at the station at 9 tomorrow morning. We'll go and have a chat to Luke's mate, Jamie Sullivan, the last person who admits seeing him alive.
He looked at Fork. If you're still in town.
With a wave, he headed off into the night. Back in his room, Fork lay on his bed and pulled out his mobile. He held it in his palm but didn't dial. The huntsman had disappeared from above the lamp. He tried not to think about where it was now. If you're still in town, Rako had said. Fork was all too aware he had the choice. His car was parked right outside. He could pack his bag, pay the bearded bartender and be on the road to Melbourne inside 15 minutes. Rako might roll his eyes and Jerry would try to call, but what could they do? They wouldn't be pleased, but he could live with that.
Barb, though.
Fork could picture her face with unwelcome clarity. Barb would be dismayed. And he wasn't entirely sure he could live with that. Fork shifted uncomfortably at the thought. The room felt airless in the heat. He had never known his own mother. She had died in a hemorrhaging pool of her own blood less than an hour after he was born. His dad had tried hard even, to fill the gap. But any sense Fork had growing up of maternal tenderness, every warm cake from the oven, every over-perfumed cuddle, had come from Barb Hadler. She may have been Luke's mother, but she'd always made time for him. He, Ellie and Luke had spent more time at the Hadler's house than at any of the others. Fork's own home was often silent and empty, his father trapped for hours by the demands of the land. Ellie would shake her head at suggestions they go to her house. Not today, she'd say. When he and Luke had insisted for variety, Fork always found himself regretting it. Ellie's house was messy, with a whiff of empty bottles. The Hadler's place was sunlit and busy, with good things coming from the kitchen and clear instructions about homework and bedtime and orders to turn off that damn TV and get some fresh air. The Hadler's farm had always been a haven, until 2 weeks ago, when it had become a crime scene of the worst kind. Fork lay unmoving on the bed. 15 minutes had passed. He could be on the road by now. Instead, he was still there. He sighed and rolled over, his fingers hovering over his phone as he considered who he needed to inform. He pictured his St Kilda flat, the lights off, front door locked up tight. Big enough for two, but for the past 3 years, home only to him. No one was waiting there anymore. No one fresh from the shower with music playing and a bottle of red breathing on the kitchen counter. No one eager to answer the phone and interested to hear why he was staying a few extra days. Most of the time he was fine with that. But at that moment, lying in a pub room in Kiwara, he wished he'd built a home a little more like Barb and Jerry Hadler's than one just like his father's. He was due back at work on Monday, but they knew he'd been at a funeral. He'd avoided saying whose. He could stay, he knew. He could take a few days. For Barb, for Ellie, for Luke even. He'd built up more overtime and goodwill on the Pemberley case than he could use. His latest investigation was a slow burn at best. Fork mulled it over and another 15 minutes passed. Finally, he picked up his phone and left a message for the financial division's long-suffering secretary, informing her he'd be taking a week's leave for personal reasons, effective immediately. It was hard to say which one of them was more surprised. Chapter 9. Jamie Sullivan had been at work for more than 4 hours by the time Fork and Rako tramped across his fields. He was on one knee, his bare hands deep in the dry dirt, checking the soil with scientific scrutiny. "We're going to the house," he said when Rako told him they had questions about Luke. "I need to check on my gran anyways." Fork studied Sullivan as they followed him towards the low brick building. Late 20s, he had a dusting of straw blonde hair that was prematurely thinning at the crown. His torso and legs were wiry, but his arms were built like pistons, giving him the shape of an inverted triangle. At the house, Sullivan led them into a cluttered hallway. Fork took off his hat and fought to keep the look of surprise off his face. Behind him, he heard Rako swear under his breath as his shin connected with a footstool lurking by the door. The hallway was chaotic. Every surface was crammed with ornaments and knick-knacks gathering dust. Somewhere deep in the house, a television blared. "It's all Gran's," Sullivan answered the question that neither of them had asked out loud. "She likes them and they keep her," he considered, "present." He led them through to the kitchen, where a bird-like woman was standing at the sink. Her blue-veined hands trembled under the weight of a filled kettle. "Right there, Gran, fancy a cuppa? Let me." Sullivan hastily took the kettle from her. The kitchen was clean but disorganized, and above the stove a large scorch mark stained the wall. The paint had blistered and was peeling away like an ugly grey wound. Mrs. Sullivan glanced at the three men and then back at the door. "When's your dad getting home?" "He's not, Gran," Sullivan said. "He died, remember? 3 years now." "Yes, I know." It was impossible to tell whether she was surprised by the news or not. Sullivan looked at Fork and nodded towards the doorway. "Could you take her through? I'll be in a minute." Fork could feel the bones through the loose skin of the old woman's arm as she leaned on him. The living room felt claustrophobic after the brightness of the kitchen, and everywhere half-empty cups jostled with blank-eyed china figurines for precious space. Fork led the woman to a threadbare armchair near the window. Mrs. Sullivan sat down shakily with an irritated sigh. "You officers are here about Luke Hadler, aren't you?"
"Don't touch those,"
she snapped as Rako went to move a pile of dog-eared newspapers from a chair. Her vowels carried a trace of an Irish lilt.
"No need to look at me like that. I'm not completely daft yet. That fella Luke was round here, then went off and did away with his family, didn't he? Why else would you be here? Unless our Jamie's been up to something he shouldn't."
Her laugh sounded like a rusty gate. "Not that we know of," Fawkes said, exchanging a glance with Rako.
"Did you know Luke well?"
"I didn't know him at all, other than he was friends with our Jamie. Came round from time to time, gave him a hand on the farm."
Sullivan came through carrying a tea tray. Ignoring his gran's protest, he cleared a space on the sideboard and waved at Fork and Rako to sit down on the battered couch.
"Sorry about the mess," Sullivan said, handing round cups. "Gets a bit tricky."
He glanced towards his gran and turned his focus instead to the teapot. He had shadows under his eyes that made him look older, Fork noticed. But he had a confidence about him, the way he took stock of the situation and managed the room. Fork could imagine him away from all of this, wearing a suit in a city office somewhere, making six figures and blowing half of it on expensive wines. Sullivan finished passing out the drinks and pulled up a cheap wooden chair. So what do you want to know?
We're tidying up one or two loose ends, Rako said. For the Hadlers, Fork added.
Right, no worries if it's for Barb and Jerry, Sullivan said. But look, the first thing I want to say and what I told the Clyde cops is that if I'd known, if there'd been any suggestion that Luke was about to go off and do what he did, I'd never have let him leave. I want to say that straight off. He looked down and fiddled with his mug.
Of course, mate, no one's saying you could have stopped what happened, Rako said, but if you could run through it one more time, that would be helpful, so we can hear for ourselves, just in case.
Rabbits, Sullivan told him. That was the problem. One of them, at least. Hard enough to get through the drought without them attacking everything worth eating. He'd been complaining in the fleece the night before, and Luke had offered to give him a hand.
Anyone here you're making the arrangements? Fork said.
Probably, I don't remember specifically, but it was pretty busy. Anyone could have heard if they'd bothered listening.
Luke Hadler pulled up at the entrance to the field and climbed out of his ute. He was 5 minutes early, but Jamie Sullivan was already there. The pair each raised a hand in greeting. Luke reached into the cargo tray for his shotgun and took the ammunition Sullivan handed him.
Come on, let's get these bastard bunnies of yours, Luke said, flashing his teeth.
You supplied the ammo, Rako asked. What kind?
Winchester. Why?
Rako caught Fork's eye. Not the missing Remingtons, then.
Did Luke bring any of his own?
I don't think so. My bunnies, my bullets was my way of thinking. Why?
Just checking.
How did Luke seem to you?
I don't know, really. I've gone over that in my head a lot since then. But I suppose I'd have to say that he seemed fine. Normal.
Sullivan thought for a minute. By the time he left, at least.
Luke's first few shots were poor, and Sullivan glanced over. Luke was chewing on the skin around his thumb. Sullivan said nothing. Luke shot again. Missed.
All right, mate, Sullivan said reluctantly.
He and Luke tended to confide in each other as much as Sullivan did with any of his friends, which was to say, hardly at all. On the other hand, he didn't have all day to get these rabbits dealt with. The sun bored down on their backs.
Fine, Luke shook his head, distracted. You?
Yeah, same.
Sullivan hesitated. He could easily leave it there. Luke shot and missed again. Sullivan decided to try to meet the man halfway.
My gran's getting a bit on the frail side these days, Sullivan said. Can be a handful.
She okay? Luke said without taking his eyes off the rabbit warren.
Yes, just a bit tricky looking after her sometimes.
Luke nodded vaguely, and Sullivan realised he was only half listening.
That's bloody women for you, Luke said. At least yours can't run around carrying on about God knows what anymore.
Sullivan, who had never once in his life considered his gran to be in the same category as women, struggled to think of a response.
No, I suppose not, he said.
He felt they had somehow strayed into uncharted waters.
Everything okay with Karen?
Oh, yeah, no worries.
Luke levelled his gun, pulled the trigger. Better this time.
You know, Karen's Karen, always something happening.
He took a breath as if to say something else, then stopped, changed his mind. Sullivan fidgeted. Definitely uncharted waters.
Right.
He tried to think of something else to add, but his mind was blank. He glanced over at Luke, who had lowered his gun and was watching him. Their eyes met for a moment. The atmosphere had become decidedly uncomfortable. Both men turned back to the warren.
Always something happening, Rako said. What did he mean by that?
Sullivan looked at the table miserably.
I don't know. I didn't ask. I should have asked, shouldn't I?
Yes, Fork thought.
No, he said.
It probably wouldn't have